Christians. Muslims, who distinguished themselves as patrons of learning, established some of the biggest libraries of times. The great intellectuals of their age, the renowned translators who were entrusted with the responsibility for the organization and maintenance of libraries.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Every night and every day, never forget to say, La ilaha
The Limelight.
Following the Israeli regime's brutal war in Gaza, most of the Islamophobic incidents in the United Kingdom involve people who are being targeted because of their support for Palestine. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British news reporter The Independent has covered this story and tells us more. A new report has revealed that the number of Islamophobic incidents has risen sharply in the United Kingdom following the Israeli regime's brutal war in the Gaza Strip, leaving British Muslims in fear. According to a report by The Independent on Sunday, 25th of February, most of the Islamophobic incidents in the United Kingdom involve people who are being targeted because of their support for Palestine. A Muslim woman told The Independent that she was targeted because she had a Palestinian flag in her window, adding that she could have been killed by a brick thrown through her window because of her support for Palestine. A 17-year-old teenage student also said he was questioned by his teachers after he displayed a Palestinian badge on his bag at school. The student went on to say that he felt targeted because he was a Muslim, which triggered an anxiety attack and led to exam failure after he was interrogated by teachers about his faith and his understanding of Hamas. A 32-year-old doctor also said he has been too scared to leave his home after an attack he believes stemmed from his support for Palestine. He was awoken on 5th of February after a large rock smashed through a window at his Manchester home, which displayed a Palestinian flag. He said this event has been extremely traumatic and has had a significant impact on his well-being, adding that he was unable to sleep and took 2 weeks off work as a result of the incident. Majid Iqbal, the Chief Executive Officer of the Islamophobia Response Unit, a charity which supports victims of Islamophobia, noted that there was a 365% increase in reports of Islamophobic incidents in October of 2023, following the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas's surprise attack on the occupied Palestinian territories on 7th of October. Majid Iqbal said, since October of last year, the Islamophobia Response Unit has seen a sustained increase in reports to the unit, warning that it is clear that this is now developing into a long-term trend and is having a profound impact on those affected by it. Majid Iqbal further called on press and politicians to not demonize legitimate Palestinian activism and, by extension, British Muslims, to avoid feeding into the serious societal problem of Islamophobia. Talmama, which monitors anti-Muslim incidents, also said there were 2010 Islamophobic incidents between 7th of October last year and 7th of February this year, more than triple the 600 reported during the same period in previous year. The Israeli regime launched its deadly bombing campaign against the Gaza Strip after the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas waged Operation Al-Aqsa Storm against the occupying regime. So far, tens of thousands of Palestinians, many of them women and children, have been massacred in the Israeli regime's brutal onslaught on Gaza. Ever since, reports of Islamophobic acts and attacks on pro-Palestinian activists have been growing across the world. Observers say Muslims, especially Muslim women wearing a hijab, have been insulted and attacked on the streets of Britain. Qatar's Al Jazeera television network has also covered the same story and tells us more. London's Metropolitan Police said there has been nearly 370% increase in Islamophobic hate crimes in the British capital London amid the brutal Israeli bombardment of the Gaza Strip. Between 7th of October last year and 10th of February this year, the Metropolitan Police recorded almost 2,100 Islamophobic incidents in London, up from 600 in the same period last year. Metropolitan Police said a man was arrested for 10 alleged incidents of Islamophobic graffiti at a bus stop in New Malden and in Raynes Park in South London. Police said in a statement recently, "Regrettably, despite the increased presence of police officers, we have seen a significant increase in hate crimes across London. This includes abuse directed at individuals or groups, in person or online, racially or religiously motivated, criminal damage and other offences." Tell Mama, which monitors anti-Muslim incidents, said it had received 2,000 cases up to 7th of February this year. London's Mayor Sadiq Khan also confirmed that the war on Gaza Strip is having a direct impact on London and Londoners, with increasing cases of Islamophobia in the British capital London. An independent team of United Nations human rights experts has found racism in the United Kingdom to be systemic and eroding the rights of Muslims and people of colour. The United Nations human rights experts say racism in the United Kingdom is structural, institutional and systemic, warning that Muslims and black people in Britain continue to encounter discrimination and erosion of their fundamental rights. The United Nations Working Group of Experts on People of African Descent said in a statement at the end of a landmark tour of the country, it said, "We have serious concerns about impunity and the failure to address racial disparities in criminal justice system in Britain, deaths in police custody, joint enterprise convictions, and the dehumanizing nature of the so-called stop-and-search policing strategy." The United Nations Human Rights Council appointed experts said during their official visit to Britain, they had gathered evidence of all-too-real trauma felt by Muslims and black people who were suffering racial discrimination and injustice in Britain. The Middle East Eye has also covered the same story and tells us more. Several Muslim human rights groups have jointly denounced state-sponsored Islamophobia facing Muslims across Europe, warning that Muslims are unjustly placed on blacklists around the European continent. Addressing the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, OSCE's Human Dimension Conference in Warsaw, Poland recently, seven Muslim civil society groups from Austria, France, Sweden, Spain and the Netherlands sounded the alarm bell over the climate of state-sponsored Islamophobia in their respective countries. Representatives from Britain, Austria and France also attended the conference organized by the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, where each Muslim group had 3 minutes to address the session. The gathering came just days after Polish authorities banned Mohammad Rabbani, managing director of CAGE, a UK-based advocacy organisation, from entering Poland after his name appeared in a no-entry list to the Schengen zone. During his speech at the conference, Adani Al-Kanfoudi, a spokesperson for Muslim Rights Watch in the Netherlands, said he was due to meet Mohammad Rabbani alongside other European Muslim civil rights societies and groups. Kanfoudi said, "This incident, among many others, is a perfect example of a broader pattern where key figures from the Muslim community in Europe are unjustly placed on blacklists."
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Aperture.
Welcome back to Aperture. In the first part of the program, we went beneath the world's oceans to discover what has happened to the millions of tons of chemical weapons that have been dumped in the sea since the early 20th century. Now, as we have entered the 21st century and forgotten the days of the war, real time bombs are ticking under the seas of the planet. The Baltic Sea, the most polluted sea in the world, is rife with tons of highly toxic and explosive cocktails of chemical weapons inherited from two world wars, which threaten us today. Stay with us for the second part of the documentary as we go across the Atlantic to see the legacy of two world wars all around the United States coast.
First of all, we are interested in that the fishing vessels and the fishing or the fishers are not getting injured by fishing that substances up, and therefore we encourage them to, by having a regime here in the Danish area where we compensate them economically by paying, in fact, the same amount for the cost of the value of the fish they could sell on the market.
Here we have the mustard gas in the middle of the fishes. That is something that has happened through the years, going from fluid to solid mustard gas.
We have recent cases, both in Denmark, but also elsewhere in the world, where you see that the fishing vessel, the people that are dealing with the chemical substances afterwards are contaminated and injured. So we still find subjects that contains both chemical substances but also the explosive. We have a 24/7 365 response team ready to go out to sea and assist fishing vessels that have caught chemical combinations. So that is the unique part of the unit here in Bornholm. The last chemical report that we have was in March this year here, so it's a couple of months ago. That's the only one this year. So compared to in the 90s, where we had more or less between 50 and 100 cases per year, it has gone down.
In recent years, deep-sea construction projects began in the Baltic Sea, and with them came fears that pollution could result with an accidental disturbance of the chemical arms.
The Nord Stream project is setting new benchmarks. The dual pipeline, which is more than 1,200 kilometers long and runs through the Baltic Sea, links the energy markets of Western Europe and the huge natural gas reserves in Russia.
We're in Lahnfurt, Germany. This is where the pipeline comes out of the Baltic Sea, and this is where the gas enters the European gas grid. The munitions issue meant that we had to do extensive detailed surveys. Once the alignments of the pipelines were defined, we then did the detailed munitions surveys. We did very high-resolution side-scan sonar surveys, magnetometer surveys, and bathymetric surveys. And then within the installation corridor, so that's where the pipeline could touch the seabed, we did gradiometer survey works and visual inspections. And out of those, we identified over 400 munitions along the pipeline route. To allow us to have a safe corridor, we had to clear munitions within plus or minus 25 meters of the Nord Stream pipelines. So prior to the installation, we cleared munitions through using detonation techniques in the Gulf of Finland and in Russia. And in Germany, we lifted the munitions that we found close to the route. We had located a number of chemical munitions, and these were avoided.
The Nord Stream gas pipeline had to be constructed around the dangerous zones because so far no European country has taken responsibility for cleaning up the chemical munitions in the sea. Americans who fought two world wars far from their own shores have now discovered a dangerous surprise close to home. United States officials now admit that thousands of tons of their own unused weapons were dumped by the military all around the U.S. coasts.
I was working on a investigation involving the local disposal of military munitions at the local bases when I saw photographs in the 1950s, the 1940s, and the 1960s of barrels and barrels of mustard gas and Lewisite and phosgene loaded up on barges being towed to sea. There are photographs of barrels of mustard gas being thrown overboard. The military's records were very sketchy. They were scant. They were conclusive to a degree that they were quite sure that there were a number of dump sites, dozens of them, off of 11 different states in the United States, presumably off of some coasts of some other countries as well. That was an eye-opener. There are three chemical weapon dump sites the U.S. Army has identified to very vague degrees off the coast of Virginia. One of them is right off the coast of Virginia Beach here, where all these people are playing volleyball and laying in the sun. It is in very deep water, presumably around 12,000 feet or so. It's out near the continental shelf. That's where the records indicate this dump site was created back in the 1940s. They can't say with any degree of certitude if it actually is that far out. The reaction was one, I would say, of shock. It was shock within the U.S. population. It was shock within Congress. Congress had no idea this had been going on or that there were potential dangers off of their coastlines. That they were shocked that there was little in the way of active monitoring of these dump sites or in the way, as far as they could tell, of any research being done to confirm their locations or to find other ones that the Army fully admitted that they expected to be out there. They just hadn't had any idea where they would be.
In the wake of Bull's investigations, the U.S. Congress called upon the Army to increase its efforts to locate dump sites. That work goes on today at the very facility where the U.S. produced its massive chemical weapons arsenal.
My work here has been mostly archival research on when we started, why we started, where we started dumping chemical munitions. White binders are pretty much all of the information that in the last 5 years we've been able to find on the chemical weapons disposals and some conventional in U.S. waters. It is putting a puzzle together in many, many instances because you find a piece of correspondence, say, that Edgewood's got some 4.2 white phosphorus rounds and some 4.2-inch mustard-filled rounds. We need to dispose of them. They are unsafe, unserviceable. They cannot be reconditioned. So you've got that piece of paper, okay, but all of a sudden you get a piece of paper out of Norfolk Navy. I go, wait a minute, now I know what they did with them. And, whoa, we've got the boat. So we go and we find the logbook. And hopefully the captain put in the latlongs. You know, how long did it take him and when he went back to shore? Anytime that you find something that matches up, it's like I can only equate it maybe to a jigsaw puzzle with 10,000 pieces. How long would that take you to put together? I don't know. Don't want to find out.
William Brankovitz was the first to chart U.S. chemical weapons dumping at foreign and domestic sites for the U.S. Defense Department in the 1980s.
part of the problem at the end of the war was we captured a great number of those chemical weapons, as did the Russians. And we all share some of that legacy today. Some of those chemical weapons were returned to the United States for exploitation to be looked at and to be evaluated and tested. But the rest of it was, again, thought to be excess to anyone's needs. So a great many of those chemical weapons were taken out to sea and were sea disposed at the time. That pretty much continued right into the 1960s. And in the 1960s, people became concerned about, is this really the way to get rid of chemical weapons? There were a series of chemical weapons disposals that were planned at the end of the 1960s in an operation called Operation Chase. The last one was under a great deal of controversy. By that time, everyone had started to realize that there were potential problems. And so the Army asked the National Academy of Sciences in 1969 to take a look at this problem and do a study and see what the best way was of doing this disposal action. They issued it, and it basically said, due to the fact that we don't know completely how the fate of this material is resolved on the ocean floor, we recommend that you stop sea disposing of chemical weapons. And we moved away at that point in time completely from ocean disposal of chemical weapons. I think about 2 years later, in 1972, there was a congressional act that made it illegal.
The Pentagon began a pilot program to study environmental effects off the coast of Hawaii, where it dumped tons of conventional and chemical munitions over the decades.
I think we've all learned things, that the ocean is not a garbage dump. And if you dump something into the ocean, it does have environmental effects. When you understand that, today we're taking a look to see what those effects are. We're looking at the fish. We're looking at the other biota in the sea to see what effect it has had to determine whether removal is an appropriate course of action. What is down there has been down there 30, 40, 50 or more years, in some cases 80 years. There's a lot of work the environment has done on these munitions, and that work has been to slowly dissolve them and absorb them. And when we're not finding an adverse impact to health, life, safety, leave in place is continuing to be the right solution. I'm not saying that we won't find a location where we make a different decision. But when we're using a science-based approach, we really want there to be an understanding of the effect on the environment, an understanding on the effect on people, and understanding what happens when we bring it up out of the water. Is that really the safest, most risk-averse manner of handling this?
The United States and Great Britain have extended official secrecy until 2017. And for the last 60 years, scientific research on chemical weapons in the sea and the dangers they pose has been limited because of this military control. Canada launched a big effort to dispose of chemical weapons during World War II. One retired Army mine clearing expert has combined environmental concern with an entrepreneurial approach and become a crusader for cleanup.
Good afternoon, I'm Wendy Bergfeld, and this is Main Street. And on today's program, a conversation with Terry Long, a former military engineer, an explosive ordnance disposal expert, more than 30 years experience, and he is sounding the alarm. Our conversation on today's edition of Main Street.
I was born in Sydney, Nova Scotia, and I grew up here. Cape Breton Island is an island. We have a big lake in the middle of it called the Bedore Lakes. It's a very beautiful island, pristine in some areas. When you start looking at in the Badura Lakes, there's actually five munition sites, and one is a chemical weapons disposal site from after the Second World War. Johnstown was used for a chemical weapons facility. Everything was secret. They didn't want people to know that this was actually being manufactured here. It was the same thing after the war when they started to look at decommissioning. It was basically just tear down the structures and leave it. And there was, again, no knowledge that it was a chemical weapons site, so nobody would suspect anything there at all. So when I started looking at that, I started feeling compelled that I had to do something to protect their lake. And then when I started looking outside of Nova Scotia, again, I was getting shocked. All these different munition sites all along the eastern seaboard, all along the west coast of Canada, and all around the world, from the Baltic Sea to the Sea of Japan. The first thing I did is I did a Canadian Senate hearing, and I took the First Nations of Wagobok with me so we could actually talk about it from the perspective of First Nations, as them being the keeper of Mother Earth. So at the Senate hearing, we discussed the different sites, what some of the contaminants are. Two recommendations came out. The first was the United Nations should have an international conference to address sea dump munitions. The second was is we needed to develop a stakeholders group that encompassed everybody to actually look at the effects from the munitions. So what happened is, because there was no international conference, I developed the International Dialogue on Underwater Munitions, and that became the International Platform for Munitions.
My name is Albert Marshall, and I am from the Moose Clan. I am from Mi'kma'ki, the Mi'kmaq territory, back during the war. We used to see these planes going back and forth. As a matter of fact, there was a lot of bombs dumped into the Badura Lakes. Kerry Long informed me of what compounds that these bombs had, because in a lot of our observations, we used to see a lot of unusual lesions in some of these aquatic life. Personally, I've had 6-7 members of my immediate family that have died from various strains of cancer. And even as we speak, I have a granddaughter at the Children's Hospital in Halifax with cancer. Badura Lakes has been a lifeline for our people for so long. Factoring our 7 generations, we have to also ensure that our future generations will also have the same privileges as we have today.
Canadian authorities had never admitted that chemical weapons were dumped in the Badura Lakes, but they haven't denied it either, and for Terry Long, that silence speaks volumes. Concerns that dump sites cannot be cleaned up without injury to humans and damage to the environment has hindered such efforts. But Japanese officials, pushed by economic interests, decided to move ahead. They founded the first industrial program to clean up chemical weapons in the seas. But Imperial Japan produced large quantities of weapons containing mustard gas and lewisite in the 1930s. They used them against civilians during the invasion of Manchuria in 1937, killing thousands. Poison gases were produced here at Okunoshima Island. The work was so secret the island was removed from Japanese maps during World War II. Today the island is called Bunny Island. The bombs in the Kanda port lie just 10 meters deep, and the Japanese government negotiated a contract with Kobelco, a giant steel corporation, to clear the weapons and destroy them. Kobelco technology is beginning to interest other countries like the United States, Belgium, and France. The Kanda experience and Kobelco's cutting-edge research with underwater robotics demonstrates safe cleanups can be conducted in depths of up to 150 meters safely for humans and the environment. 1 million tons of chemical weapons lie in the depths of the seas. Some have been there for more than 70 years now. Most countries clearly don't want to take responsibility for cleaning up their own weapons, and many other munitions belong to no country. For example, who will pay for the weapons made by Germany during World War II and dumped by the Allies? The Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, which won the 2013 Nobel Peace Prize, has a mandate to end the spread of chemical weapons around the globe. Since 1992, 190 countries have signed the convention prohibiting chemical weapons. However, the OPCW has never taken a stance on the issue of munitions dumped in the sea. Terry Long, with the support of Baltic state officials, brought his group and the problem to The Hague last spring to urge the organization to support clean-up efforts.
Good afternoon. I'd like to welcome everybody here today to this side event at the LIPA room. My name is Terence Patrick Long. I'm the chairman of the International Dialogue on Underwater Munitions. What is desperately needed is ownership and leadership and the coordination of international efforts to adequately address sea dump chemical munitions.
We think that time is really ripe to act, because weapons are surfacing and calling for action. We are truly convinced that the member state of the OPCW will finally listen to us.
Every now and then people are asking us, is the leakage increasing or not, or is the environmental damage ongoing? We cannot answer them with the degree of certainty we would like to have.
The worldwide dumping of sea dump chemical munitions by the international community was a mistake. We all seriously need to accept the obvious, that substances that are too toxic to touch with the ungloved hand has no place in our marine environment.
It's urgent that scientists be free to continue their research. The military secrecy imposed by the Allies since the Potsdam Conference in 1945 must be lifted. This is essential to effectively evaluate the risks these weapons pose to man, the environment, and the food chain.
That the states involved in creating this disaster will finally clean up and take responsibility for their previous actions before it is too late and the legacy of the world wars takes its toll on the world's next generation. Let's wait and see. And that's it for this week. Thank you. Do join me again next time here on Aperture. Goodbye for now.
In the limelight.
In the U.S., a judge has dismissed a lawsuit by Republican officials in Texas against immigration policies central to President Biden's border strategy. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. A national broadcaster, CBS News, has covered this story. A federal judge on Friday, 8th of March, dismissed a lawsuit by Republican officials in Texas that sought to shut down a federal program that has allowed hundreds of thousands of migrants to fly to U.S. airports, preserving, for now, a policy central to the Biden administration's immigration agenda. The dispute centered on a Biden administration program that allows up to 30,000 migrants from Cuba, Haiti, Nicaragua, and Venezuela to enter the United States each month if they have American financial sponsors. Those permitted to fly to the U.S. under the policy have been granted 2-year work permits under an immigration authority known as humanitarian parole that President Joe Biden has used at an unprecedented scale. The Biden administration has argued the policy discourages would-be migrants from those four crisis-stricken countries from journeys to the U.S.-Mexico border and entering the country illegally. The program was announced in January of 2023 in conjunction with a bilateral agreement in which Mexico agreed to accept the return of migrants from Cuba, Haiti, Nicaragua, and Venezuela who crossed into the U.S. illegally. In its lawsuit, Texas said the program bypassed limits that Congress set on legal immigration levels and violated the spirit of the parole authority, which it argues should only be used on a limited basis. But U.S. District Judge Drew Tipton ruled on Friday, 8th of March, that Texas lacked legal standing to sue over the policy because it had failed to show it had suffered an injury due to the program. He dismissed the case without ruling on Texas's claims that the federal initiative is illegal. As of 8th of February, more than 365,000 Cubans, Haitians, Nicaraguans, and Venezuelans have arrived under the Biden administration's sponsorship policy, according to Internal Department of Homeland Security data obtained by CBS News. Representatives for Texas Governor Greg Abbott and Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton, two vocal Republican critics of President Joe Biden's immigration policies, did not immediately respond to requests for comment. The survival of the sponsorship program is a major legal victory for the Biden administration, which has sought to combine legal migration pathways and tighter asylum rules to contain unprecedented levels of migrant crossings along the U.S.-Mexico border with varying degrees of success. In a statement on Friday, 8th of March, Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas said other countries around the world see the sponsorship initiative as a model to tackle the challenge of increased irregular migration that they too are experiencing. The White House also welcomed Judge Tipton's decision. The U.S. newspaper, the Texas Tribune, has also covered the same story and tells us more. A federal judge in Texas rejected a lawsuit on Friday, 8th of March, filed by Attorney General Ken Paxton against the Biden administration immigration program that allows each year up to 360,000 people from Cuba, Haiti, Nicaragua, and Venezuela to legally migrate to the United States. U.S. District Judge Drew Tipton, a Trump administration appointee in Victoria, wrote in his ruling that Attorney General Ken Paxton's office have not proven that Texas has suffered an injury and therefore do not have standing to maintain this lawsuit. Judge Drew Tipton, who has previously ruled against the Biden administration in other immigration-related lawsuits, wrote in his opinion that he does not address the lawfulness of the program, rather that Texas has not established that it is standing to sue. Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton, whose office led a coalition of 20 other states, filed the lawsuit in January of 2023 against the Biden administration shortly after it announced the program. Texas argues in its lawsuit that the program harmed the state because immigrants approved under the program qualify for state services, such as healthcare and public education. It's one of over 24 lawsuits that Texas has filed since January of 2021, seeking to reverse the Biden administration's immigration policy. In court filings, lawyers representing the Biden administration said the program encourages would-be migrants to use a lawful way to enter the United States rather than crossing the border with Mexico illegally. They also argued that Congress has given the executive branch the authority to implement such a program. As of January, a year since the program was first announced, over 357,000 people have been accepted into the program. According to the lawsuit, 13,990 applicants who were accepted listed Texas as their destination. More than 2,600 were children. With a historically high number of people arriving at the U.S.-Mexico border from Cuba, Haiti, Nicaragua, and Venezuela, many of them crossing illegally, the Biden administration created the parole program to provide a safe and legal way for them to enter the United States.
اقرأ باسم ربك الذي خلق.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. يا أيها المزمل قم الليل إلا قليلا نصفه
أو انقص منه قليلا أو زد عليه ورتل القرآن ترتيلا.
ودعوتك ربي بقرآنك جنبني حراني.
Let's recite the Quran.
ناجيتك أرجو غفرانك يا من ينجينا إحسانك. ودعوتك ربي بقرآنك.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرج.
السلام عليكم and welcome to Let's Recite the Quran Kareem, a series of Quranic sessions held by IRIB English Radio in cooperation with Sevier International Schools Network. I'm really, really glad to have Brother Hussein Akbari and Fawad Haider with me today in the studio. Assalamu alaikum, Fawad Haider.
Salam, sir. How are you?
Alhamdulillah. I'm good. How about you?
I'm good, sir.
Alhamdulillah. Salam, Hussein. How are you?
Salamun alaikum. I'm fine.
Fine? All right. So everyone is fine here. So brothers and sisters, dear listeners of IRB English Radio, thank you so much for joining. I will, inshallah, together... We will practice page 155, ayah 43, Surah Al-A'raf. Is that right?
Yes.
Yes? Hussein?
Yes.
Ready, everyone?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Brothers and sisters, we'll practice this ayah today, inshallah. So get your Quran with you, page 155, Surah Al-A'raf, ayah 43. Let's listen to the recitation.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. ونزعنا ما في صدورهم من غل تجري من تحتهم الأنهار وقالوا الحمد لله الذي هدانا لهذا وما كنا لنهتدي لولا أن هدانا الله لقد جاءت رسل ربنا بالحق ونودوا أن تلكم الجنة أورثتموها بما كنتم تعملون.
A very nice recitation that was. I really enjoyed. Did you enjoy? Huh?
Yes.
Yes?
Yes.
Okay. So, let's see what Allah Almighty says in this ayah and let's practice the tajweed rules and inshallah we will practice also the recitation because after the tajweed rules are practiced and learned, so we have to know how to recite the ayah beautifully then. All right, based on tajweed rules.
Yes.
Let me read it once. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم ونزعنا ما في صدورهم من غل تجري من تحتهم الأنهار. Allah Almighty says, we will remove whatever rancor there is in their breasts, whatever hatred, whatever kind of black spots, whatever, okay, like these things in their breasts, in their chests, we will what? We will remove them. تجري من تحت الأنهار, and the streams will run for them. وقالوا الحمد لله الذي هدانا لهذا وما كنا لنهتدي لولا أن هدانا الله. And they will say, all praise belongs to Allah Almighty who guided us to this. We would have never been guided had not Allah guided us. لقد جاءت رسول ربنا بالحق. Our Lord's apostles had certainly brought the truth. وَنُودُوا أَن تِلْكُمُ الْجَنَّةُ أُورِثْتُمُوهَا بِمَا كُنْتُمْ تَعْمَلُونَ. This is so beautiful. Allah Almighty says, and the call would be made to them. It will be announced to them. Okay? This is paradise which you have been given to inherit because of what you used to do. This ayah talks about the people in the heaven, in the Jannah. All right?
Yes.
Somebody recite this ayah once, Hussein or Fawad. Who wants to recite? Hussein, you want to recite?
Yes.
All right. Recite it once.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
ما شاء الله.
ونزعنا ما في صدورهم من غل تجري من تحتهم الأنهار.
أحسنت.
وقالوا الحمد لله الذي هدانا لهذا وما كنا لنهتدي لولا أن هدانا الله.
أحسن. Wait. So, let's practice what we have to focus on this, okay? There are some points that we need to focus in recitation. Yeah? Fawad?
Yes.
So, ونزعنا ما في صدورهم. Was that correct? Sudurihim. That was correct, yes?
Yes.
He read it correctly. But next one, min ghillin.
Yeah, he was
he applied the rule ikhfa. Yes. He hid the sound of noon. Well, he didn't have to hide the noon sound. How should he read? For what? Can you read it? Ma fi sudurihim min ghillin. How do you read it?
It's min ghillin tajri.
Min ghillin. There's no changes. Yeah?
Yes.
Min ghillin. You don't read it. Min ghillin. Okay? No. Min ghillin. All right, Hussein?
Can you explain why, sir?
All right. Yep. Noon sakin. After noon sakin, we have the letter. What letter we have?
Yes.
Ghain. Yes?
Yes.
The letter ghain. So whenever you have noon sakin, after noon sakin, you have ghain, ayn, hamza, ha, ha, kha, these six letters, you bring no changes to the noon.
What's the name of this group?
Izhar letters or the throat letters, okay?
Yes.
So throat letters, you never change the sound of noon. You read it the way it is. You pronounce the noon clearly, yes, without any
changes.
Min ghillin. All right? But next one, ghillin, it has tanween. Tanween is the same as noon sakin.
Yes.
After tanween here, ghillin, lin, you have what? Ghillin, you have the letter ta.
Yes.
Ghillin tajri. Here you should hide it.
You should hide it.
Because ta is from the
rest of
ikhfa letters. Yes, the rest of the letters, ikhfa letters. It is included in that group. So it says that you have to hide the sound of tanween. So you read it this way. Min ghillin tajri. Min ghillin tajri. And also مِن تَحْتِهِمُ الْأَنْهَارُ مِن You hide the sound of min here because you have a ta after that.
قَلْبٌ بِالْحَقِّ تَعَلَّقْ وَبِغَارِحِ رَاءَ تَأَلَّقْ يَبْكِي يَسْأَلُ خَالِقَهُ فَأَتَاهُ الْوَحْيُ فَأَشْرَقْ اقْرَأْ
Let's recite the Quran.
اقرأ بسم ربك الذي خلق.
So, وقالوا الحمد لله الذي هدانا لهذا وما كنا. What do you do here? Hussein, read it. وما كنا.
وما كنا لنهتدي لولا أن هدانا الله.
Good. Was there any mistake?
No, I didn't find.
No? Alright, but I found some mistakes. Look, Hussein. وَمَا كُنَّا لِنَهْتَدِيَ This was correct this time. The first time he said لِنَهْتَدِي لَوْلَا لِنَهْتَدِيَ لَوْلَا Then he again applied the rule إِخْفَى with the word أَن. He said أَن هَدَانَ اللَّهُ هَا is from izhar letters.
Throat letters.
Did you get it?
Yes.
Okay. So read it again, Hussein. Do not hide it. No. An hadana Allah. Read laula.
Laula an hadana Allah.
Good job. This is very good. Nice one. So the people in the heaven, they will have no jealousy with each other, okay? Because jealousy doesn't have a meaning there. There's no jealousy. People will not hate each other. Though, for example, their rank will be different.
Yes.
Yeah? But they have no hatred. They are not jealous about each other. Why he has that rank? Why I don't have this rank? I hate him. I'll fight him. No hatred. No enmity. There's nothing.
So there are no emotions or no...
No, we... Look... Emotions, we have good emotions, we have bad feelings, yes? Good emotions, and also the bad ones.
Yes.
So there will be nothing bad in heaven. Because everything is good. Everything is enjoyable. Everything is happiness. Alright? Yes. So, and also the people in the heaven will be so thankful to Allah Almighty. So guys, this ayah is so beautiful. And I want you to refer to the Tafsir books to learn more about it. There are a lot of great points. So, at the end of the ayah, Allah says, "Antilkumul Jannah wa nudu antilkumul Jannah." Okay? Before that, the people in the Jannah will say that, "Oh Allah Almighty, whatever your Rasul, your prophets brought us, they were truth." Okay? We found them truth. The prophets say that you have Jannah, you have hellfire. And they are correct. We see them. And also, Allah Almighty tells them, okay, that this is the Jannah that you were given the news.
Yes.
Okay? That with good deeds, of course, you will inherit this.
So I have a question.
Yeah.
So the people who are dead, for example, everybody enters heaven after Day of Judgment, or there are already people over there?
No, after the Day of Judgment is held.
So everyone goes to heaven.
Yeah, Day of Judgment happens, and then people go to hellfire, people go to heaven.
So all the people go together.
Yeah, of course.
And one.
All right. But who enters first, it's arguable, okay? There are many hadiths that you can refer to the Tafsir books. So let's finish the Tajweed part and let's recite this. وَمَا كُنَّا لِنَهْتَدِيَ لَوْلَا أَنْ هَدَانَ اللَّهِ Make sure it's not أَنْ هَدَانَ اللَّهِ أَنْ هَدَانَ اللَّهِ لَقَدْ جَاءَتْ The mad is?
Wajib.
We got extended. رُسُولُ رَبِّنَا بِالْحَقِّ وَنُودُوا أَنْتِلْكُمُ الْجَنَّةَ أُورِثْتُمُوهَا بِمَا كُنْتُمْ تَعْمَلُونَ These are the easy rules that
yes.
you already know them. Alright, Hussein and Fawad, time to recite together. I will recite, you should repeat after me, okay?
Yes.
So, brothers and sisters, make sure you repeat after us. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
ونزعنا ما في صدورهم من غل تجري من تحتهم الأنهار
ونزعنا ما في صدورهم من غل تجري من تحتهم الأنهار
أحسنت وقالوا الحمد لله الذي هدانا لهذا وما كنا لنهتدي لولا أن هدانا الله
وقالوا الحمد لله الذي هدانا لهذا وما كنا لنهتدي لولا أن هدانا الله
Ahsan. That was good. It's a long part of this ayah, yeah?
Yes.
It's okay. لَقَدْ جَاءَتْ رُسُلُ رَبِّنَا بِالْحَقِّ
لَقَدْ جَاءَتْ رُسُلُ رَبِّنَا بِالْحَقِّ
ونودوا أن تلكم الجنة أورثتموها بما كنتم تعملون
ونودوا أن تلكم الجنة أورثتموها بما كنتم تعملون
صدق الله العلي العظيم
صدق الله العلي العظيم
That's all from us for today, brothers and sisters, dear listeners. Thank you so much for being with us up to this time. See you inshallah in the next station. Stay with IRB English Radio, Fawad and Hussein Akbari. Thank you so much for being with us in this session. See you inshallah next session. Walhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. وصلى الله على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم
Let's recite the Quran, a joint production of IRIB English Radio and Xavier International Schools.
ذكر وموعظة ونور فيه شفاء للصدور وشفيعنا يوم النشور آياته تروي المدى وصفاته نبع الهدى نلقى الجنان بحبه لن تستقيم حياتنا إلا به هو القرآن والفرقان إليه تنصت الأكوان وفيه تعطر الآذان والقرآن
IRIB English Radio
This is IRIB English Radio.